Straight Talk from Israel.
You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio. And now, here is Walter Bingham.
Hello and welcome to the Walter Bingham File. It's the 8th of May, 2018, and in our calendar, the 23rd of Iyar, 5778, and it's also the 38th day of the Omer count. I'm your host, Walter Bingham, and in today's program, I bring you two of my more memorable interviews from days gone by. You will hear the experiences of a Jewish astronaut. Then there is the story of a savior of nearly 700 Jewish children from the clutches of the Nazis. And some words from the Russian general who liberated Auschwitz. And you will hear the conclusion of Jeff Mekanoff's journey through Jews for Jesus into Messianic Judaism and, thankfully, back again into the fold of Torah observance. So please write and let me know if you enjoyed this kind of program, away from the depressing news of the day. The email is walter@israelnewstalkradio.com. The pre-World War II Jewish population of the world was approximately 17 million, a small fraction, 0.8%, of the then global population. Yet in all great scientific discoveries and enterprises in medicine, in culture, in music, in literature, in you name it, Jews were and are again prominently involved. Almost all scientific research is based on the theories of Albert Einstein. The father of the nuclear bomb is Robert Oppenheimer, and there were many others. As I said in last week's program, it's interesting to delve into the past and see what happened years ago that influenced our today. One of those momentous events was space exploration. I'm sure you all know about the late Neil Armstrong, the first man who stepped on the moon and said the now famous words, "That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind." That was 49 years ago. There were only a very limited number of Earthlings, human beings, who experienced the
And now, here is Walter Bingham.
The Russians called them cosmonauts, and we coined the name astronauts. Of course, Jews were also among them. I'm sure that you can name at least two who unfortunately lost their lives in tragic accidents. You'll hear all about Jewish astronauts after the break.
Israel News Talk Radio, straight talk from Israel.
Shalom from the heartland of Israel. This is David Ha'ivri. Join me every Tuesday at 5 p.m. Israel time, 10 o'clock Eastern, for A Hebrew in the Heartland on Israel News Talk Radio. Hear the news and views from the heartland of Israel every Tuesday at 5 p.m. Israel time. Be there.
And now, here is Walter Bingham.
I'm talking about Jewish astronauts. I'm sure that you can name at least two who unfortunately lost their lives in tragic accidents. Ilan Ramon, an Israeli, who after 16 days in space lost his life on February the 1st, 2003, when the space shuttle Columbia disintegrated upon re-entering the Earth's atmosphere, killing all seven crew members. Then there was Judith Arlene Resnick, who died with the rest of her six colleagues when the space shuttle Challenger was destroyed during the launch on January 28, 1986. And this was to be her second trip. On her first trip, Resnick logged 145 hours in orbit. May their memory be as a blessing. But do you know if there were any other Jewish astronauts? And if so, how many? Two more? Three? Four? Well, let me surprise you. Of 789 astronauts and cosmonauts from 135 NASA space shuttle missions, 14 Jewish astronauts flew 43 missions between them. A standard, I'm sure. And the mathematicians among you can work out the percentages and compare them with the 0.7% Jews in the world today. Israel can be proud of our achievements. One Jewish astronaut from the United States is Jeffrey Allen Hoffman, who not only flew 5 missions, but made 3 spacewalks, totaling more than 22 hours to repair the Hubble telescope. He logged more than 1,211 hours and flew 21.5 million miles in space. Here is my telephone interview with him made in 2003 for one of my Jewish programs in the UK.
But I really apologize for the very poor sound quality, that we sound as if we were both in space. The sound quality of the mini-disc deteriorated over time, and it wasn't the best of telephone connections. We worked hard to improve it, even to this, because we thought that it's well worth listening to.
Well, it's an honor and a pleasure to welcome you to the program, Dr. Hoffman. You are certainly a member of a very elite group of people who have experienced something that was only a dream when you were born, and many of us still dream it might happen to us someday. Why and when did you first get interested, first of all, in astrophysics?
There was a lot of talk about the coming space age. And so for me, it was very real, the idea that we were going to fly in space. It was just a question of when. I knew all about how we were going to do it.
Well, you've certainly done it. But without blinding me with science, which are not very good, tell me very briefly, what is astrophysics and what is your field within it?
Astrophysics is a combination of astronomy and physics. And basically, it's astronomy because you're studying things that are not on the Earth. Rather than just look out there and try to describe what we see, which is the way astronomers originally started many years ago, we actually try to apply the laws of physics to understand how the stars work, how do they generate energy on a physical and chemical basis, how the universe works.
How did you think about wanting to become an astronaut? Because there must have been and still are thousands of hopefuls.
I was always interested in space travel, as I said, and when people first started flying in space in the early 60s, I followed the program with great interest. Now, I had always had this dream of wouldn't it be great to fly in space, and of course, I wasn't alone. In fact, there were over 8,000 people who responded back in 1977. But I was fortunate enough to be one of the 35 chosen to become the first group of shuttle astronauts.
Now, would you say that you were particularly gifted as a child, or has any good science student a realistic chance to get into NASA? Because the selection process must be quite stringent.
Well, just being a scientist will not do it. Being an astronaut, it goes beyond this. I mean, I was not selected to be an astronaut to carry out my own program of scientific research. It's a much more of a generalist position. There's a great many physical activities you have to do. You also have to become acquainted with very complex machinery, and you have to be able to work in a very hazardous and unforgiving environment where if you make a mistake, you can endanger not only your life, but that of your crewmates and hundreds of millions or even billions of dollars of equipment. They look for ability to function in difficult situations. Also, they want people who can work as part of a team. But there's no question, everybody who's selected has to be excellent in whatever they do.
Well, you certainly proved your excellence. And we've talked about your background and your academic background. Now, let's talk about the actual space experiences. First of all, give me a brief idea about the training. That must have been very rigorous.
It certainly was. You have to be familiar enough that the things that break down and you have to take corrective action, you can do it in a hurry. There's a certain amount of physical training. You have to be reasonably healthy. The space flight involves significant physical stress.
During the training, did you at any time reach a point at which you felt, oh, well, that's too hard, and maybe
The basic psychology is we're going to do everything that we can do to make sure that this works.
I'm sure that to be finally accepted, Dr. Hoffman, as an astronaut must be quite exciting. But then when you are eventually selected for flight, that must surely be an almost indescribable feeling. What was it like for you?
Well, obviously, the reason you become astronauts is to fly in space. When that call comes, it gets a lot more real.
I could imagine, I'm not sure if I'm right, that there's a bit of a rivalry among astronauts, perhaps even bordering on envy. So when you were selected for your first flight, did you experience anything like that, particularly as a Jew? And I take it that your Judaism was no secret.
No, but it certainly was not a factor of NASA. It was believed that people had many different roles. So it's just not something that people talk about. The big difference nowadays, and particularly during the time I was an active astronaut, compared to the early days of the 60s, was there was a place for everybody. So there was not that sense of, well, if somebody else gets the flight before me, never any doubt that I was going to fly. You know, given the fact that I successfully completed the training.
Right. But on your first flight was in April 85 in the Shuttle Discovery. I'd like to know what went through your mind when the engines were lit, and tell me about that and about the takeoff in particular.
You go out there the morning of launch and you realize there's nobody else on the launch pad except for maybe a half a dozen people who are helping you get on board. Because it's only loaded, and it's creaking, and there's hydrogen fires burning, and I mean, the vehicle is alive. And, you know, it's what you made me think, you know, this is danger involved in what I'm doing. But, you know, that's not the time to worry about the danger. I had made the decision a long time ago that I wanted to fly in space. I mean, it's just my psychology. I can say to myself, look, you decided that you were going to do this. Let's sit back and enjoy the flight. What a flight it was. I didn't really know what to expect. I mean, sure, people had told me that when the solid boosters ignite, it's a bit like getting a kick in the pants. Hearing it in words and actually experiencing, you know, 7.5 million pounds of machinery all of a sudden lurch off the pad and just head straight up into the air, and I could look out the window and I just see the ground literally fall away from me. And within 2 minutes, the blue sky had turned dark black, and we were in space, and we were still going. And, I mean, it's just an absolutely extraordinary sensation of the power of machinery that I was in on top of that's going to take me up into space and accelerate me to 18,000 miles an hour. That takes about 8.5 minutes. And at that time, all of a sudden, I didn't stop. It's quiet. You know, I looked out the window, and there was the Earth down below. And then I realized that I was floating in my feet, and I just got this sense of elation. You know, I had a smile. I looked in the mirror, and I just couldn't stop smiling. It was extraordinary.
Now, after all that training for weightlessness that you just explained, and then the real thing, and that was, of course, different. For instance, eating and writing and all the other necessary things. How did you keep the paper and the utensils in place?
You need a lot of Velcro, a lot of clamps, rubber bands. We're constantly making improvements. But basically, without Velcro, without great tape, we couldn't do
space. I take it that at that point, you don't wear spacesuits.
That's correct. The inside the shuttle is a short-sleeved environment.
Everything on these flights is pre-planned and tested over and over again, and then suddenly the unexpected problem.
We spend 90% of our training practicing for failures, but of course nobody has planned for what actually happened.
Well, then this sudden problem arose. You are told now it's your turn. Put on your spacesuit and tether yourself up and go. Were you scared?
I have to say honestly that the only thing that I was scared about that time was that there was a change in the morning and let it go out.
Really?
We were very well trained. Despite the fact that we were not planning to make a space suit, we got the training. I felt very well prepared and very confident.
After your first flight, it wasn't until some 5.5 years later that you made your second flight that was in the Shuttle Columbia.
We were actually supposed to make our second flight less than 1 year after my first flight. My second flight would have been the very next flight after the space shuttle.
And now, here is Walter Bingham.
Because of that, all flights were canceled. Flight schedule was rearranged. I resumed flights in 1990, and between 1990 and 1992, I actually did three flights. That was a very good time.
More after this.
Hi, I'm Rabbi David Aaron. The soul basics are the most profound, the most essential, and yet often the most neglected in our education. Join me for Soul Talk on Israel's News Talk Radio and discover the secrets to love, spiritual growth, and personal power.
Now, here is Walter Bingham.
My other spacewalks were on my fourth flight, and that was the famous rescue mission for the Hubble spacewalk. That was the most complex of any spacewalk that was in Endeavor.
How long were you out there?
My longest spacewalk was a little over 8 hours.
What about food in those 8 hours?
We got candy bar, lunch on.
I can
sort of reach over and grab it with your teeth and pull it a little bit out. And I usually manage to do that two or three times before my chin would hit the candy bar and knock it back down or smack it.
Most often you would be dressed up in a spacesuit and even your hands would be in the cupboard. And then you have to do intricate repairs with tools. That must be difficult.
Very challenging, very challenging. Some of the equipment of it, actually, has been specially designed so that people working in space don't have to put around with tiny little screws, which, as you say, are very difficult. But not all of it, and we did have to do some things which really challenged us, where I think we were kind of on the edge of what we could do. I actually did manage to accomplish everything we set out to.
Now, these spacewalks must have been literally an out-of-this-world experience. Hey, could you, in one word, describe them?
In one word? No.
In two words.
It's the most intimate experience you can have of space. I mean, it's sort of like, you know, you can look out a window of a submarine or a glass-bottom boat, but to actually go outside and dive into here is a whole new dimension of experience in the ocean. And that's what it's like sitting on the space.
Right. You mentioned before the Challenger accident. You must have known and perhaps even trained together with the Jewish astronaut.
She was in my class.
She was killed in the 86 Challenger accident. Now, were you scared after that?
No more than I had been before, because I always knew that there was a potential danger. I think it hit a lot of people. It made it harder for a family. No question.
Sometimes you must have been a little bit fearful.
You know, fear is a very personal emotion. I was always aware of the danger of what I was doing, but was I actually scared? No, but that's not because of being brave or anything. You have to learn to take this concern, and I guess different people deal with it psychologically in different ways, but you have to sort of put it to the side and get your work done. Fear is the incapacitating, and if you can't deal with it, you should be doing something else.
When I first saw Jerusalem from just a few hundred feet above ground while I was piloting a light aircraft, I was very emotionally moved. So seeing the whole of Israel, for instance, from outer space in these large parts of our planet, did you feel anything special?
The most ancient part of human civilization, knowing that they're down there on the ground, together with this most modern person, local, not always be present.
These experiences that affect your view of God, because there must have been occasions when you were speculating perhaps on the creation or had spiritual thoughts.
I don't think so. For me, it was more a sense of experience in the different aspects of creation. To look at the sun against a black sky and realize that the sun is truly a star is extraordinary. Put the sun as one among the myriad of stars we see at night. The other thing was to see the effect that human beings have had on our planet.
Now, I want to come back a little more to the Jewish perspective. How do you then reconcile astrophysics with the Jewish, the Torah account of creation?
I'm not a fundamentalist, so I don't have a problem with reconciliation. I don't have to struggle with that as a literal interpretation.
One of the practical aspects of it, for instance, I have nothing problem about Shabbat in space when you see the sun sets approximately every 90 minutes.
You see Jerusalem time or you see time when you're an astronaut. I mean, you can work these things out. Just there's a spirit which is willing, there's always a way.
Were you ever inspired while you were in orbit to pray?
When I went up on my last flight, I actually brought the Sefer Torah, which I had taken various Jewish ritual objects from all my flights at the beginning, including from this resort, and during the Hubble flight, it was during Hanukkah, so I took the menorah.
Did you like it?
No, first of all, candles don't really burn in white Russian. They suffocate themselves.
That you nail or fix the
mezuzah
to your bank?
Well, I'm glad you mentioned the word nailing, because nailing a mezuzah to the door would not be a good deal in space, because a nail hole through the door, your oxygen's out. So, as with everything else in space, we use Velcro. So I put a little bit of Velcro on my bunk, and I should say we have to share bunks. We worked on two ships.
Yes.
And I for the first 4 or 5 days, I was putting the mezuzah up on the outside of the, or the inside of the box, and then when I would get up in the morning, I would take it down. My crewmate, Scott Horowitz, who's also Jewish.
Oh, I see.
So after that, we just left it up for the rest.
And when you had that Sefer Torah with you, did you open it, read from it?
Yes, I read the Bereishit.
Did you? And how many miles did you travel in space, and how many hours were you up there? And would you do it all over again?
Well, the last one is easy. I mean, if they offered me another chance to go up, I certainly would, without any doubt. I've spent about a little over 50 days in space, about 1,200 hours. Then we were going about 18,000 miles an hour, I think about 2,500 miles. Still just taking 5 miles up there. I never really kept track of the miles. I will say, on my last flight, when I clicked off 1,000 hours, I was actually the first astronaut to accumulate 1,000 hours of flight on the space shuttle. We did have a little celebration.
Were you in contact by telephone with your family?
When you're up for more than 10 days, you're given one or two personal, private phone conversations with your family.
Jewish astronaut and spacewalker extraordinaire. Thank you for telling us this fascinating account of your experiences.
That was Jewish astronaut Dr. Jeffrey Hoffman, who is 73 years old, but at the time of the interview was, of course, much younger. Soviet General Petrenko is best known as the liberator of Auschwitz. At the anniversary of the liberation, I sat with him, and he had this to say to me.
Участие в освобождении So it happened that I was
upon triumph.
Them who was liberated, Auschwitz.
Что положить конец кровавым злодеяниям нацистов.
General, I remember well some years ago at the 50th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz when you came to London and you delivered this wonderful speech. Why are you not speaking today?
Мне очень приятно быть only for us.
It was very pleasant for me second time visited England and met again with some person that remembered me.
Здесь люди правильно понимают, что такое Холокост, что такое день поминовения.
It's very important that in this country everybody remember it. How it's important to remember about the Holocaust. And this Memorial Day should be, it's a good example for my country too.
Вам доброго здоровья.
Best wishes to Jewish community.
Thank you very much, General. And I must say, at your age, you look resplendent in your uniform.
Большое спасибо и хорошего вам пребывания здесь.
Вам все, спасибо.
Best wishes.
Надеюсь, здесь много друзей.
I hope that many friends that remember it me, maybe they will listen my voice, and I send the best wishes to everybody to be today with us.
There are lots of men and women here who were liberated by you at Auschwitz, and I'm sure they will be forever grateful to you.
Друзей.
I have many friends.
Всего вам доброго.
Best wishes.
His name will forever live on in the annals of Jewish history.
I have often talked about another liberation, the Kinder Transport, an event that over a period of about 8 months brought about 7,500 of the scheduled 10,000 unaccompanied children to England. It started in late December 1938, just after Kristallnacht, until the outbreak of World War II, when it abruptly stopped. But there was another unconnected effort by one man, Nicholas George Winton, a British humanitarian and stockbroker by profession, who organized the rescue of 669 children, most of them Jewish, from Czechoslovakia on the eve of the Second World War in an operation that later became known as the Czech Kinder Transport. It was when he heard of
and the now,
of
here is Walter Bingham
to rescue German and Austrian Jewish children on that so-called Kinder Transport that he summoned a small group of people to organize a similar rescue operation for children imperiled by the impending German dismemberment of Czechoslovakia in March 1939.
There was a time you didn't worry about terrorism. It was something that happened in a faraway place or to someone else. But now you want to know. Now you want to understand. Now you're afraid that you might be in the danger zone. You need to listen to Gadi Edelman on The Danger Zone every week, where you will find out the truth about what is going on in the world around you. Gadi Edelman on The Danger Zone, right here on Israel News Talk Radio.
And now, here is Walter Bingham.
All about Nicholas Winton, who saved Jewish children. He raised money to fund the transport of the children and the £50 per child guarantee demanded by the British government to fund the children's eventual departure from Britain. He also had to find British families willing to care for the refugee children. By day, Winton worked at his regular job in the stock exchange and then devoted late afternoons and evenings to his rescue efforts. He made a great effort to raise money and to find foster homes to bring as many children as possible to safety. The first transport of children organized by Winton left Prague by plane to London on March 14, 1939, one day before the Germans occupied Czech lands. After the Germans established a protectorate in the western Czech provinces, known in German as Sudetenland, Winton organized seven further transports that departed by rail out of Prague and across Germany to the coast of the English Channel, and then by ship across the English Channel to Britain. At the train station in London, British foster parents waited to collect the children. The last train load of children left Prague on August 2, 1939. Rescue activities ceased when Germany invaded Poland and Britain declared war on Germany in early September 1939. After the war, Nicholas Winton's rescue remained unknown, and it was not until 1988 when his wife Greta found a scrapbook from 1939 with all the children's photos and complete list of names of those rescued that his rescue efforts became known. Winton since received a letter of thanks from the late Ezra Weizmann, former president of the State of Israel, and was made an honorary citizen of Prague in the independent Czech Republic. In 2002, Winton received a knighthood from Queen Elizabeth II for his services to humanity.
I am now sitting next to Mr. Nicholas Winton, who was honored in no small way this evening. Mr. Winton, what moved you at that time to do what you did?
Well, I was in Prague on vacation and was in contact with the people who were looking after the camps. And I was shown the problem and told that there was no organization that could help the children. And I said if it could be done, I would try and do it.
How did you have that influence? What was your position?
I had no influence whatsoever. I mean, when I came back to England and asked the Home Office, told them what the position was and could I bring children in, they said certainly. It's just that nobody else had tried.
And how many were there altogether?
I think around about 700.
And how do you feel about this evening's ceremony?
I think it's marvellous that this took place. I think the whole thing should be rather called the Holocaust than the Holocaust. But otherwise, I think it's something which had to be done sometime.
And we've seen that the world hasn't learned yet.
No, one wonders if it will.
Mr. Winton, I'm privileged to speak with you. And having been a kinder transport child myself, it's particularly poignant for me to speak with you.
You came from Germany, did you?
Yes. Thank you very much.
Although I cannot agree with his view to apply the term Holocaust to other atrocities, I join Jews all over the world in saluting him. Sir Nicholas Winton died on July 1st, 2015. He will never be forgotten. And now for the conclusion of Jack Nikonoff's journey of discovery. The story so far. A young Jew, brought up secular and without strong Jewish identification, was looking for a meaning in life. He moved in Christian circles, married a Catholic girl, then slid into the net of Messianic Jews. He flirted with evangelical Christianity and drifted from one belief system into another, but didn't feel really comfortable in any. This part starts with the edited end of last week's installment. Your situation is like that of a mixed-up kid that needed help. Did you then seek help?
I didn't seek help. I wanted to spend some time away and just find myself, I guess you'd say. However, I still wanted to learn. I wanted to learn about authentic Judaism. I went to a local Judaica store in Merrick, and there was a sign up on the window, beginner Torah classes, beginning Judaism. Come, non-judgmental, come ask your questions. Sit down and schmooze with the rabbi. So I said, what's this? I took it, and I just showed up at one of these Wednesday night classes, and the rabbi, Rabbi Yossi Korngold, bless his soul, he's a great guy, sat down with me, said, tell me your story. I told him pretty much everything I told you. I was mixed up at the time, and he just sat there and listened and smiled, and he said, I don't blame you. Who wouldn't take that path if they grew up with nothing, with just floundering in the middle of an ocean with no anchor? He goes, you found an anchor, you buoyed yourself to it, and this was your truth. And it was only after learning about Torah with him, through him, through books, through other rabbis and other organizations, that I understand now that I was looking for truth and to solidify something. I'm a very black and white person, but with my belief system of God, if 2 + 2 = 4, the law of physics and God have to be the same. There can't be 20,000 different truths towards theology and God.
So did you then eventually break with all this Shuva Israel and these messianic groups and broke off with all your former friends?
I broke off immediately, and David Rosenberg, the messianic pastor, who called himself the messianic rabbi, kept calling me and emailing me and saying, come study with me and learn. You're struggling with your faith. And I didn't want to go back because I knew he was very influential with me, and we were friends, and I just wanted some time away. And I was intelligent enough to do something like that because I know you can't be involved in the middle of something and break away from it. So I literally cut it all off in one swoop.
That must have been very difficult, particularly in the framework of a mixed marriage.
So when we left, my wife said, okay, we're leaving. Fine. Leave me alone with your religious beliefs. Let's just do whatever we got to do as husband and wife. Love each other, but don't bother me with religion anymore. You're crazy. Okay. Leave me alone.
How old was your boy at that time?
My boy was 2. He just turned 2.
So he didn't understand about these 2 religions in the home?
No, my daughter was just about to turn 5.
Oh, how did she feel about these 2 different religions at home?
We didn't call them 2 religions. We didn't look at them. We looked at it as 1. So everything we did culturally was Jewish. And we wouldn't talk about Jesus in the house. It was just known between myself. And this is how it's done in a lot of messianic houses, where you look at the house, there's Judaic all over the place. You know, there's Jewish pictures, there's pictures of Rebbeim, there's pictures, there's mezuzah, there's 1 mezuzah up in the front door, kosher or not, I don't know. But everything about the household is Jewish.
So you were conducting a kosher home? That must have been a problem with your non-Jewish wife at that time.
We weren't kosher whatsoever. We were still eating whatever. But the look and feel of the house was 100% Jew. If a secular, typical American Jew walked into my house, there's nothing threatening whatsoever. It's, oh, you guys are Jewish. That's nice. That's it.
But at that point, had your wife thought of converting? Was there a disagreement between you?
No, at the time, it wasn't even in my mind. I just wanted to learn. I started studying Torah with Robert Korngold. I'll explain what happened next. And he started saying, why don't you investigate a little about going to Orthodox synagogues, see what they're like. He had a beginner service, which I liked. There was a lot of singing and clapping. The one thing about the Messianic movement, which I love more than anything, is the music and the singing and the clapping and the joy. And that's what drew me in, and that's what kept me there, besides the theology and learning with the Messianic rabbis and the teachers. The joy kept me there. Everyone was always happy. And if something went bad, the whole congregation would pray for you. And then they'd have prayer lists throughout the country that pray for you. So there was a connection there, which a lot of organizations don't have. So what I would do is I'd start going a little synagogue hopping, Orthodox synagogue hopping. People were nice. They were welcoming. But I didn't have that joy. It was just about open this book and say the prayers.
You obviously didn't hit Chabad Shul at that time. Because at the Chabad Shul, you would have felt that same tearing and praying and singing and clapping that you like.
Definitely, and that's what I'll lead, that my story leads to but later on. But what I did is I started getting a mailing list for Torah groups, and there's one group in Manhattan. It's actually an Israeli-based group called Israelite with Rabbi David Aaron. And he has a few books, and he had a group in Manhattan, and they flew in Rabbi Benny Friedman. He moved him and his family to Boca Raton for 2 years, and every Tuesday, Rabbi Binney would fly to New York and have this Torah class in the city. And I used to get these emails. I'm like, why is this guy coming from Boca to New York every week? I have to check this out. People actually have to be worthwhile. So I walk into this thing. I remember it was New Year's Day, 2002. I drove to the city. I park my car. I go in. I walk into the synagogue. And in a circle is a whole batch of hippie-looking Orthodox Jews wearing woolen kippot, and they're playing guitar, and they're singing. And I learned later on, it was Karlbach type songs. I was blown away by this now. I'm like, oh, Jews do this. Jews are happy. Hashem led me to this place, but thank Hashem I found it because I didn't know what I'd do without the music, without the joy. So I started attending this place every Tuesday night, religiously. I'll use the word religiously.
You earned your living as a disc jockey, interestingly enough, as an entertainer. Now, many functions and much clubbing takes place at weekends. That means starting Friday nights. How did you deal with that from your orthodox point of view?
Well, the great thing about the teacher, Rabbi Kornblum, who I was studying with, he didn't make a big deal out of it. He understood where I was at right now, and his way of doing outreach is you do one thing at a time, one step at a time. Don't push everything onto somebody right away, because I've seen it happen, and he's seen it happen numerous times. That's a boomerang effect, where someone takes on all the halakhas within 2 weeks. They wear a black hat, they grow a beard, they're wearing all the accoutrements of a religious Jew. 6 months later, they bounce right back, and they become an atheist because they did it too fast. So we're studying Torah, we're studying oral law, the written law, and it came to a point where I was learning about Shabbat. And I was working Friday night, Saturday days, and we're learning about carrying and Erevim. So what I would do, if I had a Saturday afternoon party, I would load my vehicle on Friday late evening before sundown. So now, even though I was driving to this party on Saturday afternoon and doing the party and doing all the breaking of the laws, I was doing one thing at a time. Besides learning the halakha, I did a few parties. One in particular where it was a Sweet 16 on a Friday night. I remember driving to the hall. It was sundown. I had this feeling in me like, well, I shouldn't be doing this. I get to the place. I'm playing predominantly Spanish and rap music. And they're dancing on the floor, and they're drinking alcohol out of this little flap. So now they're getting drunk, 16 years old, dancing to music I'm playing on Shabbos. And it just, this is, what am I doing? And I committed at that night, I'm not working Friday night ever again, and I will eventually get my Saturdays, but I had to make money. And the Saturday parties weren't so bad because they were, even though they weren't religious Jewish, they were still Jewish, so there was a level of Hamishness, there was a level of family-style entertainment going on.
So what did you do? You're still working as a disc jockey now, aren't you?
I said, okay, 1 year from now, I am stopping the Saturday party. I'm becoming Shomer Shabbos. So what I had to either quit the business or do something else. So I stopped advertising, I stopped marketing myself. I would stop putting parties on Shabbos, period. And I decided to get into another field totally unrelated. Real estate, which I couldn't stand because 20 years doing what I do, being your own boss, entertaining people, dealing with music, dealing with people dancing, you can't put that person in an office 9 to 5. So that lasted 3 months. And then I said, I have to just do what I do best through a Torah perspective. And also at the time, I was affiliated with Chabad. So I was davening on Shabbos at Chabad centers, and no one judged me. They were very happy. They were joyful. They were glad to see me, and I started going back, and they were always happy and glad to see me.
What happened in the end that you still continued in your business as a Shomer Shabbat, as a Shabbat-observing Jew?
Yes, so what I wanted to do was take what I do best and make it positive, make it uplifting, make it Torah-dick, make it kosher. So I actually created a kosher DJ company, which is now a kosher event company. And Baruch Hashem, it's doing excellent. It's 3.5 years old. We only do Shomer Shabbos events.
I'm interested whether you managed to continue in the business doing functions which were within the halakha.
I converted my company to an Orthodox Jewish DJ/event company. And Baruch Hashem, I'm making a living. And everything is beautiful. My wife actually is teaching full-time. And you've actually called on a very auspicious day because today is the actual conversion day for my wife and two children. We're going to the Beit Din today at 12:30 in Muncie.
Mazal tov. So your wife has actually studied for Orthodox conversion, and today she's being judged at the Beit Din whether she's fit to be taken into the fold.
That is correct. We're ready to become a true Torah Jewish family.
Wonderful. Now, you've been on a very long journey, and then you published a piece in which you said that you are glad that you embraced Orthodox Judaism via this dangerous road, and by implication you endorse the study of Messianic Judaism just in order to be able to argue why Jesus is not the Messiah. And then you claim to have learned there what it really means to be a Jew. That's very dangerous stuff. You can't be serious. What do you mean by that?
I don't say I endorse it on my site. For me personally, the path I was led on, led me to truth. It is because I was involved in it that I'm able to argue. Thankfully, I'm able to rescue people. But I don't justify that I was part of the movement and that it was a great thing. But I use my experiences of being involved with the Messianic movement to use it for good now. But I don't recommend that path for anybody. If you want to learn about Judaism or Torah or God, do not go to a Messianic congregation to learn.
I'm glad that you are stressing that, because in the same piece from which I quoted, you said, "I'm thankful that God had me there for so long, as my familiarity with the movement Christianity and their adherence gives me the right to the knowledge." And then you said you learned a lot there and so on. But that's very dangerous, isn't it?
It is dangerous, but I also look at things from a positive way of thinking. I'm not like many people. So my positive spin on that is that it was used for good. Like I said, I don't recommend anybody going in. It's very dangerous. You don't want to flirt with that belief system of Christianity or Messianic. Messianic is very, very dangerous. I implore every Jew listening to this to stay far away. I'm available for you to speak. But even though that was my path, do not take it. And like anything, I'm thankful to HaKadosh Baruch Hu for just everything he's done for me. So I have to be thankful for the knowledge I've gained being there, because it's enabled me to do what I do now. Is I literally rescue scores of Jews every year from this movement.
So there are other more acceptable ways to learn the truth about Judaism than going that way.
Oh, yeah, hundreds of ways, and I could point you to those directions as well.
Now, you have a very inquiring mind, but you also had the willpower to get out of this quagmire. But many a young Jew has got stuck, and the longer they are there, the harder it is to retrieve them. What would you say to any Jew who is interested or involved in Messianic Judaism, or even if only to perhaps be able to counter their arguments, wants to learn from them?
You actually utilize the Christian Testament to show them what they believe to be prophetic aspects of it that they're taking out of context 100% of the time, and that aspects in the New Testament that they believe to be truth about Jesus, that they make no sense when you put it into context with our Bible, especially once you go into the original Hebrew. So you argue with them the same way they got involved. A lot of times emotions are involved and life gets involved, so it's harder than that sometimes, because they're either mixed married or they've been involved 10, 15, 20 years, or they come from a problem childhood where they didn't have love and now they're getting love from this new group. They're emotionally involved, they have new friends, they love it, they're going every week and they're feeling this love that they never felt before.
So they should never even start it.
No, stay far away, and it's a lie, and it's deceiving. Anyone will love you. Any organization, you go to Jehovah's Witnesses or Hare Krishnas, they'll love you too, but it's all false. The only truth is Hashem's Torah through a Torah organization, whether it's Chabad or Aish or Sameach, Jewish Rock, Gateways, Israelites, just keep it Torah Jewish. That's all I have to say.
You have a website, Jeff. What is it?
The new website is www.jewsforhashem.com. That's one word, jewsforhashem.com.
Jeff Nekanoff, thank you very much for telling us your story.
Here is my thought for the week. We don't have to agree on anything and still be kind to each other. And now I have to end for today. But God willing, I'll be back again next week with more news, views, interviews, and perhaps more reminiscences from days gone by. Until then, this is Walter Bingham wishing you a good, happy week. And please visit your elderly neighbor and make it a happy week for him or her too. And you have my thanks too. Goodbye.
If you love Israel News Talk Radio, then you'll love our Facebook page. We keep you up to date on what's happening in Israel, plus little surprise treasures that we don't share on the radio. Go now to follow us on Facebook. Just look for the Israel News Talk Radio Facebook page, and don't forget to subscribe and follow us by clicking on the like button. We post great stuff there that you'll want to share. Israel News Talk Radio on Facebook and Israel News Radio on Twitter.
If you're hearing this message, everyone else can too. Advertise with Israel News Talk Radio and get your message out to people. We'll build a personalized package for you. Contact advertising at israelnewstalkradio.com.
Straight talk from Israel.
You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.
Hey, this is Jake in Anchorage, Alaska, and I love listening to all the super interesting interviews and up-to-date information on what's happening in Israel.
Hello, this is Anna King, originally from London, now living in Israel. And what can I say? Israel News Talk Radio is my cup of tea.
My name is Bhaskar. I'm from India, and I love listening because you get to know the truth and wonderful voices from this lovely country.
Mom!
Okay, wait a minute.
Hi, this is Chava Dax, and I'm calling from the rolling hills of Maale Adumim, just north of Jerusalem. I always listen to Israel News Talk Radio to get all the latest news and commentary and to keep me up to date every day.
This is Sarah Dax from Maale Adumim, and I'm 12. I wish Israel News Talk Radio was boring so my mom wouldn't listen to it all the time. Mom!
You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.
News, opinion, and more.
You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.